From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Today on Fresh Air, I'll speak with poet Robert Bly, whose work has been inspired by nature, political protest, and fairy tales. Also, veteran New York reporter and columnist Pete Hamill will explain why he left his city to edit a Mexico City newspaper, but returned home in frustration just a few months later. Jazz critic Francis Davis will review a new album by British violinist Nigel Kennedy, who interprets the work of Ellington and Bartok. And television critic David Bianculli previews the life and loves of a she-devil, a British miniseries as excessive as its title. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bly, who is considered one of the leading voices in American poetry. His early poems in the 1950s were reflective about nature and solitude. In the mid-60s, Bly wrote that America needed political poetry, and he became a poet activist. He read at anti-war demonstrations, and he co-founded the group American Writers Against the War in Vietnam. When his anti-war volume, The Light Around the Body, won the 1967 National Book Award, he turned the $1,000 prize over to a draft resistors group. In the mid-70s, Bly's inspiration turned from political issues to mythology and fairy tales. The poet's role, he said, is to return to the mother culture. By that he meant the traits that were traditionally identified with the female gender, like nurturance and intuition. He tried to cultivate what he considered his female side and urged other men to do the same. In 1975, he organized the first conference of the Great Mother, which became an annual event. More recently, he's devoted himself to writing about men, about the bonds between male friends and between father and son. As part of that, he's organized male retreats to release what he calls masculine energy. I asked Robert Bly to begin by reading one of his early poems.
All right, I'll read one that I wrote in the 20s. I think that every man and woman in the 20s has a fear that somehow by entering into life they will lose their soul. So I wrote something like that. It's called The Danger of Loss. On a clear day, the jealous are jealous of ash leaves, flies, all jewelry of air. They sit gloating and grumpy with rage in their blowing hair. But the kind pine, though heavenless, does not drop green tears on earth. And partnerships of sheep walk half asleep on the mountains of death. But a man may lose the jewel on earth because of wife or job. For what he saves, he cares nothing and goes sullenly to a deep grave. I must say that if I were writing it now, I wouldn't put the word wife in there. Men don't lose the jewel because of wife. I would put, but a man may lose the jewel on earth because of job or job. For what he saves, he cares nothing and goes sullenly to a deep grave.
If you had read this when you wrote it back when you were in your 20s, would you have read it the same way you did now?
I doubt it, because a great thing is involved in poetry readings, when people speak the poems aloud, is that over the course of years as you read, you become used to your own voice and the way it rises and falls on its own, which one doesn't hear when one writes. So these readings have been a great gift to me in that way.
You grew up in rural Minnesota and went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. And you lived in New York for a while, went to Harvard. But you returned to Minnesota and live again in rural Minnesota. And I wonder if that part of America has a grip on you, or if you feel like you need to live there to write your poems.
I must say that when you're going to write poetry in your life, what you need primarily is a way to live without earning much money. And my father had saved a farm for me. I didn't get any income out of it, but I could live there. So I went there out of desperation, not out of choice. And living in the country is very boring. But after all, who says that poets should live in exciting places? And then, to my surprise, once I went there, it tied back somehow to my childhood. And I was able to use words like snow and dust and cottonwood tree that had meant a lot to me in my childhood. And strangely enough, it wasn't until I did that, I was about 28, 29 then, that my first poems actually sort of coalesced, came together. So I've become very enamored of the idea of spending a lot of time where you were born.
But you're known in your community as a poet.
Yeah.
Are you known as an eccentric, too?
Yeah, I suppose. Of course. Because I am.
How so?
I don't know. It's just that when you wander around and sit under trees for a while and try to write poems, people feel you're eccentric. I don't feel so. I feel myself perfectly normal.
I'm always surprised, in a way, when a poet comes from a family or from a community where there isn't a lot of poetry or writing around. Now, I think it's fair to say that in your family there wasn't a big emphasis on literature. You probably weren't brought up reading great literary magazines.
No, that's right.
How were you exposed to literature and to poetry?
I enlisted in the Navy when I was 17, in the middle of the Second World War. There I met a man from Portland, Connecticut, and he wrote a poem in front of me. I was astounded. It's the first person I'd ever seen write a poem. And it taught me something that I had never understood. I thought poems were written by books or something, and by Englishmen. And then I realized I could write a poem. Then I went to St. Olaf College for a year, and I fell in love with a girl who wrote poetry, and I tried to write some to impress her. It didn't do any good, and the poetry was no good. But nevertheless, I felt something on the page that I hadn't intended to put there. And then I transferred to Harvard, and that gave me a sense of the possibility, which I didn't have in the Middle West at that time, of undertaking writing poetry as an actual kind of profession.
What was the reaction of your parents to your desire to become a poet, not the most lucrative profession?
My father has his faults. But in that, he was wonderful, and he never bothered me at all. I lived in New York working one day a week in my middle 20s and would come home very poor and wiped out and sick. And the only thing he'd ever said, he said, you know, if you got a job, you might be able to write more, which was very gentle, wasn't it? Very gentle.
Your early poems were very reflective, even pastoral,
mm-hmm.
Many of them about nature.
They weren't pastoral. They were about where I was living. It happened to be in the country. I believe, Machado in the Spanish say, write about where you are. If I'd been living in a city, they would have been urban.
Did you go through a period of solitude when you were starting off writing?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I got out of college, the best decision I made was not to go to graduate school. And I moved to New York, and I lived alone there for 2 years. And even though it was in the city, it was a very deep solitude because I was broke and also neurotic. And so I sometimes didn't talk to anyone for a month at a time. And that was wonderful.
Did it help you hear your inner voice not be surrounded by other
people? Great blessing. I think the ego is very wounded when we get out of college, and mine was. And so my self-esteem was very wounded. I lived as in my 20s, a classic life, as it turns out, of the young writer, say, in France. You go into a garret, you live there for 2 years, and you're a complete failure and complete nothing.
Did you, in your early years, feel connected to any larger tradition within poetry of Midwestern poets or of any Norwegian tradition? You come from a Norwegian family.
In the 50s, there wasn't any community of poets as there was in the 60s. I lived in New York for 2 years and never met a single writer, except for a European exile who stopped me on the street one day and said, are you a poet? And I said, wow, this is unbelievable. Yes. And he asked me to translate his work and so on. It was wonderful. There wasn't a tradition in Midwestern poetry. And the tradition that I had was through Yeats, and still is. I read him every day. He's my view of what a great poet is. And Frost every day.
You went from this period of solitude and of living in New York, feeling very disconnected. Then you moved back to Minnesota because you got a farm for...
Yes, because I realized that I needed time if I was going to write anything. Some people begin early. I didn't. and for various reasons which I know now is connected somewhat to the alcoholic parent, namely the denial of feelings that are involved in that. Well, if you're involved in heavy denials of feeling, how can you become a poet, which is a thing in which the emotions and the body and the brain all have to speak together? I needed time to sort that out, and so I could live on a farm for very little.
One of your early poems is about ambition. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, that's a nice thing to ask for at this moment, because in Harvard, really, we were all taught to be ambitious. I don't know what that means. It means to send your poems to the New Yorker all the time, whatever that is. Then I started to read the Buddhists, and the Buddhist said, no, that's completely off. That's completely wrong. To be a poet means to drop out of the world of ambition and allow things to speak from below. So I wrote this. We had a farm. There wasn't any water on it, so I had to pump water for the horse. And I had a single horse, and I wrote this poem. It's a four-line poem called Watering the Horse. How strange to think of giving up all ambition. Suddenly, I see with such clear eyes the white flake of snow that has just fallen in the horse's mane. And, of course, that belongs in the Chinese way. You just put the two things together and leave it to the reader to figure it out.
Do you feel that you resolve that question of ambition for yourself?
No, I don't think so at all. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran, so I go back to being ambitious every once in a while.
Ambitious
it's
and guilty.
It's the playing with it that's so fun. It's the playing with having no ambition. Or is it the playing with having ambition? I don't know.
My guest is poet Robert Bly. In the 60s, your poetry became very political, and you co-founded American Writers Against the War in Vietnam. What happened to you that made your poetry change so much? Your poetry, which had been reflective about nature, it was now very political, and some of it was really pretty angry.
I think the poems come from the same place any poems come from, somewhere in the stomach. And at that time, it was anger and rage. Partly at the betrayal of American ideals, which I had taken in. I felt the Second World War was a just war, whether it was or not. We felt it was so. But I didn't feel that way about the Vietnam War. So it was, and people were very upset at the time, you know. They said, listen, you do very well with trees, you know, why don't you stick with trees? Stop writing this stuff. But I'll read you. Would you like to hear one?
Yeah, why don't you read a couple?
This one is called As the Asian War Begins. There are longings to kill that cannot be seen, or are seen only by a minister who no longer believes in God, living in his parish like a crow in its nest. And there are flowers with murky centers, impenetrable, ebony, basalt. Conestogas go past over the Platte, murderers from the Carolinas riding under the canvas. Who are our enemies? Perhaps the soldiers and the poor, those unable to rejoice. The last phrase is from a wonderful poem by Edward Thomas, the friend of Robert Frost. The soldiers and the poor, those unable to rejoice. So it's very sad to think that in a way, it's the poverty of the people in Nicaragua that really infuriates us and makes us want to kill them. And I think another thing is that we, you know, in the Second World War, I noticed that we respected the Germans because they're big, but the Vietnamese were small. We like Buicks and Germans. And I noticed that we counted up the bodies in the Vietnam War. We never did that in the Second World War. It was heavy casualties on the German front. So I wrote this little poem. Counting small bone bodies. Let's count the bodies over again. If we could only make the bodies smaller, the size of skulls, we could make a whole plain white with skulls in the moonlight. If we could only make the bodies smaller, maybe we could fit a whole year's kill in front of us on a desk. If we could only make the body smaller, we could fit a body into a finger ring for a keepsake forever. For those of you who were too young for the war, that's what it felt like.
What reaction did you get from other poets? You were really one of the first poets to write about the war in Vietnam. You read at demonstrations. Was it accepted in the poetry establishment, accepted by your peers also to do such political work in the mid-60s?
I don't think so. In the academic community, I suppose it wasn't very established. But we were too busy to bother about that. Only Berryman, I think, called me many names and said I was ruining poetry, John Berryman.
Some political poets and playwrights can really get away with murder in a way, because if you're perceived as being politically correct and politically righteous, then it's easier sometimes to get by with form that's not as good. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if you ever felt like people wouldn't notice that much if a poem wasn't as well crafted as you'd like, because the political sentiments would catch on.
Oh, certainly. And people said at the time, you know, aren't you afraid that this political poem will be bad? And I said, well, how strange it is that when I write love poems, you don't say, aren't you afraid that this love poem will be bad? After all, a poem is made out of words, that's all. It's easy to throw them away when they're no good. You just tear up the page and throw it out. Why do we worry that political poems would be bad but not love poems? So there's some fear there. And I'm not saying that the fear isn't justified. Sometimes political poetry can wipe out some sort of subtlety and energy in the language. But I don't think it happened in this particular case. I think the greatest poems that Robert Duncan wrote, for example, were done in the war. And some of the greatest poems that Denis Levertov wrote were done in the war. They're beautifully subtle.
You had gone from being someone who was isolated to someone who was really at the center of things. You were organizing writers against the war. You were a focal point in the anti-war movement yourself. How did it change your life? I know this is a kind of it's a personal and not political question I'm asking, I guess.
Well, I'll say two things. First of all, it pulled me away from my desk a lot. And I'm glad now to be back at the desk, and I've cut out all teaching this year and whatever, so I can do a lot of work there. I had read poems, but always with my hands down. I mean, I had spoken poems before that, but always with my hands down at my side or holding a book. And it turns out that if you memorize a poem and you speak it with as great clarity as you can, with as strong emotions that are yours as you can, a brief community blossoms like a flower in front of you in the audience. That's a community of this instant. I had never experienced it in a poetry reading before that. And it's very beautiful. It opens like a flower, and when the reading is over, it closes again and it's gone. But that's the community that the ancient poets knew. That's why Homer was delivered in the way it was and why Beowulf is done in this way. There's a community with the audience that one loses or never knows about if you only write and publish.
And I guess reading at demonstrations, you probably had a great sense of the community of your, listeners, too.
I think so, because they were, sometimes when you go into a poetry reading now or any time, they're not sure if it's a cultural experience or if they should be polite, or that's not a part of the community. The community shouts and screams and says, you know, you're a fascist or whatever they do. All of that's a part of it. And so I prefer boisterous poetry readings to this day.
My guest is poet Robert Bly. Our interview will continue after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Poet Robert Bly is my guest. You turned down, you turned over the $1,000 prize that you got from the National Book Award, and you gave it to an anti-draft book. And I think your publishing company, your small press, was offered, I think, a $5,000 grant from, was it the National Endowment for the Arts?
Yeah.
And you turned that down, and I think I'm quoting you correctly. You said, since we are murdering a culture at least as fine as our own, have we the right to congratulate ourselves on our cultural magnificence? If you were offered a stipend or an award at this point, would you say something similar?
Yeah. I have continued to turn down government money. If the National Endowment grants had been given 8 years before the war, I don't think we would have had so many poets participating. It isn't that they would have been bought. It's that they would have said, well, you know, the government does like poetry. You know, it's that issue. And so I believe with Rexroth also that the poets should try to get along, conning Guggenheim or whoever they need to, but to stay away from the government so that when another conflict with the government appears, we'll be emotionally clean and not feel grateful to this government.
After your period of activism and of anti-war poetry, you moved to a much more reflective form of poetry again, and really you were plumbing the unconscious. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Well, you know, the unconscious, what does the unconscious mean? It's a word that isn't very good. It really means what we don't know. What we don't know. What the conscious, what we know. The unconscious, what we don't know. So I'm plumbing what I don't know. Well, having been brought up in the Middle West, which could be called the masculine part of the country, being a Protestant, which is a masculine religion, being a farmer's son, which is a masculine occupation, I had very little development on the feminine side. I'm not sure I still have much. But by trying to investigate the goddesses and the great mother culture, I was really investigating what I didn't know.
What instigated it? You know, what, you really were changing your focus there a lot.
Well, I think it was reading of Jung.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's my question.
Okay.
And it's a problem I've always had with Jung. He attributes certain qualities to feminine and masculine, to the male side and the female side. Why label it male? Why male certain? Why label certain characteristics as
That's
male
right.
or
it's
female?
It's a lot of trouble. Causes a lot of trouble, and it can trap both men and women in their areas. For example, the one thing I object to very much in Jung is his saying that feeling belongs really to women, and linear thinking or something to men. And I've been doing men's groups now for 5 or 6 years, and slowly I'm developing an idea that there's a male mode of feeling and a female mode of feeling. Those are modes. And the women, the mothers, teach us the female mode of feeling when we're very small. And this is, I mean, we just go to them when we're hurt in the playground and they talk to us about feeling. They're not doing anything wrong. It's the fathers that are not talking that don't help the young male learn the male mode of feeling. Is that clear what I'm saying? And therefore, the men in the last 20 years have been trying to imitate the women and imitate the male mode, imitate the female mode of feeling. It's better than none. But there's also a wonderful thing when you can break out of those categories and move over and realize that the men have very deep feelings of their own and a way of feeling them and a mode of speaking about them, which they are not given any help with by their fathers and now even by their grandfathers who are mostly gone. So the Chinese do it better because they call that the yang and the yin, and then we're not trapped in the terms male and female. I don't think it's right to say that women have all the feeling and the men have only the Pentagon. That's not right. That's crazy.
After several years of pursuing what you called the great mother or the female side of a man, you kind of gave that up almost for pursuit of male energy.
I didn't give it up, but you know, all the time, I'm looking for what I don't know. I'm trying to look in the unknown part of myself, which is dumb, dark, stupid, and deep, and way down there. And then I realized after working with the mother or something, you know, elementary material really, but news to me, that I didn't know anything about my masculine side either, especially about my relationship with my father.
One other thing on this subject, I know part of the reason for feminism and the women's movement was that many women felt that the mainstream of society was run by men and mm-hmm. defined by men, so mm-hmm. life in general was the way mm-hmm. men defined it, and women were always defined as the other.
Yep.
So in order to define that for themselves in some way, they had to get together and figure out what men were leaving out about women. But one thing that confuses me about some men's groups is since men were defining all this in the first place, what are they trying to define?
Well, you know, in talking about male gods and so on, it's very interesting that a lot of the work that the men do is, has done, have done as scholars, like Graves and so on, is accurate descriptions of women's experience. But how about the accurate descriptions of men's experience? See, we haven't done much of that.
Men haven't accurately described men's experiences?
No.
But they've accurately described women's experiences?
Not accurately, but intently and obsessively. Do you hear what I'm saying? Graves has a whole book about the white goddess. What about the male god? How come he left out that? It's as if we're fascinated by the other. So we spend all our analytical energy trying to get into that. And it takes us 2 years to go where a woman could go there in 5 minutes. But then, on our own side, women are not as fascinated with the male as we are with the female in that area. They haven't done much work talking about the male gods and the male energies. And the men have not done either. So therefore, this material is just as undefined for us. And the labor that we have to do is to go ahead and do that and make sure that we're not trying to shame women in this. This is not a competitive thing with women.
Your imagery, I think, has been very influenced by Jung and also by Freud.
Yeah.
Have you been psychoanalyzed yourself?
No.
Why not? You're so fascinated by this. Why haven't you gone to analysis?
Who knows? It can be said that when you write poems steadily and constantly, it's a form of analysis in itself. That's the way Rilke felt. And after all, I live out in Madison, Minnesota. Who's going to analyze me? It is. You understand? So I'm very interested in therapy, and I believe most therapy is tremendously helpful. I just have been too stubborn to do it.
Are you afraid that therapy would sap your creativity?
No,
or,
I don't think
or
so.
Harm your poetry?
No, I don't think so. No.
Poet Robert Bly is my guest. I want to quote something that you wrote. I can't remember when you wrote it, actually. But you wrote, "Almost all American poets I know suffer each day the anguish of having no family traditions in art, so they don't know which sacrifices are proper to make for the sake of art and which aren't." I thought that was a really interesting statement to make, and I wonder what are some of the sacrifices you've made for poetry, and ones that you feel you should have made, and others maybe that you've second guessed.
Well, the major sacrifice that one needs to make for art is some way in which you drop out of busy life somehow and have lots of time for solitude, and sometimes that involves not having any money for a long time. And at other times, it involves not receiving that steady assurance every day that people give you when you go to work. And they're there, and you know their little jokes, and they know yours, and they keep supporting you each day in a beautiful way. And somehow that's one of the sacrifices. And then other sacrifices, so I've made some of those, and they've been blessed ones.
One last question. We only have about a minute left. We were talking about sacrifices you as a poet have made in order to write poetry. And I think a question every artist has to ask themselves is what sacrifices are they willing to ask their family to make so that they can be an artist? Because they don't have a 9-to-5 job where you get a regular salary and health benefits and a pension and all that. Has that raised a lot of tough questions for you during your life?
Oh, certainly. I have one. My last boy now is in a fairly good day school in Minneapolis. The rest of them went to very bad high schools. And there was always an air of chaos around the house from not enough money. And I remember I felt that, I mean, we were glad to have a car that was 10 years old. It seemed a part of the whole thing. But then I remember one of my sons saying to me, you know, "Dad, would you let me," he had about 4 blocks from the high school, "would you let me off a block from the high school?" So one suffers some humiliation there, so to speak. Everybody, we have no right to ask our families to go through these sacrifices, but we do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems for us.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions.
My guest has been poet Robert Bly. His latest collections of poetry include Selected Poems and Loving a Woman in Two Worlds, both published by Harper and Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with Nian Chang, who has written a memoir about her imprisonment during the Cultural Revolution in China. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, veteran New York reporter and columnist Pete Hamill describes his adventures editing a Mexico City newspaper and his frustrated return back home. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis introduces us to Nigel Kennedy, a British violinist who interprets the work of both jazz and classical composers. Television critic David Bianculli previews the British miniseries The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, one of the weirdest series yet, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the latest news. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of a new recording by British violinist Nigel Kennedy. Kennedy doesn't accept the traditional boundaries between classical music and jazz. On his new compact disc, he plays the music of Bartok and Ellington.
Duke Ellington's Come Sunday from his suite Black, Brown, and Beige, as interpreted by the young British violinist Nigel Kennedy. The arrival of yet another classical violinist with a yen for jazz isn't likely to thrill jazz fans who witnessed the spectacle of the great Itzhak Perlman trying to get down and dirty with Stan Getz and Dizzy Gillespie on a PBS special from the White House a few years ago. For too many classical musicians, jazz is an occasion for sloppiness. But Nigel Kennedy is a godsend, a classical violinist who lavishes as much care on Duke Ellington's music as he does on Bela Bartok's. That's the conclusion one draws from music by Ellington and Bartok, Kennedy's new compact disc on EMI. If anything, Kennedy does Ellington more justice than he does Bartok. His reading of Bartok's Sonata for Solo Violin strikes me as slightly overinflated, although this impression might have something to do with the forced intimacy of digital recording. It has a way of making even the silences between notes sound triple fortissimo. But surprisingly, his interpretation of selected portions of Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige is above reproach. Actually, Kennedy's performance is an act of recomposition rather than interpretation. As performed by the Duke Ellington Orchestra in 1943, Black, Brown, and Beige was a sprawling mural-like work. Kennedy offers a scaled-down version for violin and bass. For the most part, he zeroed in on the first section of the work, the section that Ellington subtitled Black. Kennedy has retitled it Mostly Black because, as you'll hear if you're familiar with the original, he's taken numerous liberties with the material. So what we have here, finally, is a performance that is at once a reduction and an expansion. It's simultaneously faithful and imaginative. In other words, it's close to ideal. Here's a sample. Thank you. work song from Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, as reimagined and performed by violinist Nigel Kennedy. Kennedy is essentially a classical violinist, but his interplay with bassist Alec Dankworth on this Duke Ellington material shows that he possesses the mother wit necessary for jazz improvisation. Kennedy's dual skills in jazz and classical music should be more common than they are. After all, we hear a lot these days about how jazz and classical music are finally merging. But it seems to me that all of the meaningful gestures in this direction are coming from jazz, and primarily from its composers rather than its instrumentalists. Oh, sure, I know about Wynton Marsalis, but he plays trumpet, an instrument very few 20th century classical composers have favored with new works. And he strikes me as a jazz musician only moonlighting as a classical virtuoso. The reverse is true of Richard Stoltzman, the clarinetist with the Tashi Quartet. He approaches jazz as a dilettante. So you can see why I'm so excited about Nigel Kennedy, who clearly thinks of Bartok and Ellington not just as 20th century contemporaries, but as equals. It's ironic in a way that Kennedy is British, because he exemplifies the kind of musician American conservatories should be turning out in greater numbers, and would be, if only our classical music establishment could cure itself of its masochistic European bias.
Our jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Nigel Kennedy's new recording, Music by Ellington and Bartok. This is Fresh Air. My guest is veteran New York journalist Pete Hamill. Last year, he left New York and moved to Mexico City to become editor of the English-language newspaper, the Mexico City News. 4 months later, he resigned his post and headed back to New York. He got the job after he had written a story for the Washington Journalism Review in which he praised the paper. The outgoing editor of the Mexico City News read the story and approached Hamill about taking over his job. Soon after, Hamill was hired by the publisher. Hamill says the job offered him the chance to live out his fantasy of editing a newspaper, but the dream soon soured. I asked Pete Hamill to compare Mexican and American journalistic practices.
Well, the basic thing was what I began to think of as the great blur. You couldn't find out anything. You couldn't find out what the circulation was. I had to bribe somebody, literally, with a couple of thousand pesos in the press room to tell me what the actual press run was, and to this day I don't know for sure whether it was accurate. If you wanted to find out how much a page of advertising sold for, you couldn't find out because everybody was making separate deals depending on the advertiser. You couldn't say, okay, it's $1,000 a page or $200 a page. You did not know. I could not find that information out. The other part of it, though, was a much more ferocious kind of pressure, which was the notion of what a newspaper is. Most newspapers in Mexico follow the party line of whoever happens to own the newspaper. I didn't want to do that with the paper we had because we were an exception being published in English, and I didn't want to. I thought one of the things we could, the values we would have there would be to be in a strange way a kind of corrective to all the other newspapers. And I think that's what finally got me in trouble with the publisher.
Well, what kinds of things did you try to do that were different from what was usually done that got you into trouble?
Well, there were several things. The specific one that got me into trouble was our coverage of the strike at the university in Mexico City, which is not a small thing. There were 350,000 students out on strike. I did with my tiny, limited staff, I assigned somebody to the administration and somebody to the students and switched them off every other week so they wouldn't end up being too sympathetic with the people they were covering. And the publisher after 3 weeks, didn't want me to do that anymore. He wanted me to reduce to, in his word, virtually nothing, the coverage of the students, which meant that and the reason was that the paper had, or rather he had, a line on the strike, which was to support the administration. I happened to agree with him. I thought in this particular case the administration was right and the students were wrong, but that didn't matter. That should not affect the news pages of your newspaper. You want to write an editorial or write columns or whatever, you can do that, expressing opinion on the thing, but not to affect the news coverage of the story. And when he ordered me to do what he wanted me to do, which was to only cover the administration line and publish their handouts without any reporting on the other side of the issues, I had no choice except to resign.
You resigned over principle, and I think of all the times that someone really wants to put themselves on the line and say either this changes or I'm going to leave, but they feel that they can't because they need the salary desperately to support their family and they can't move from the city that they're in for family reasons and so on. Do you always feel like in order to take on a job like that, that you have to have the kind of freedom that would enable you to actually say, well, in that case, I'm quitting, and then leave?
I think you must, somehow or another, know that if you eat a bad meal often enough, it's going to poison your system one way or the other. So I think anybody in the newspaper business or in politics or in radio or television who continues to just do something that runs against the basic grain of their craft or their responsibility or their vocation, whatever you want to call this peculiar thing we do, then in the long run you pay for it. In the long run you're less a writer, you're less secure, because you can't stand the face you see in the mirror every day. I told my staff, here's the situation, I explained what had happened, please don't do anything impetuous, give it a couple of days, we'll talk about it, I'll try to see whether we can straighten this out, but please don't go off doing anything rhetorical. But 2 days later, when it was absolutely clear that he wanted my resignation, 19 members of the staff resigned, which was the whole city desk, the whole sports desk, the whole copy desk. They were all young people without options that I had, and I must say that I was kind of cheered, because these are those young people who are from the Reagan era, who were supposed to care only about money and not about ethical considerations, and they were putting themselves on the line, risking everything in a strange country with no union, with no support system, no welfare, no unemployment, who just took a walk on a matter of principle, and I must say I was kind of thrilled at that.
I wonder if they've gotten jobs.
A lot of them have, yes. Some have gone to the wire services and stayed in Mexico. One of the guys just started last week here in New York at the Daily News. A couple of are freelancing. Some went back home. But they all continued to function, and I think they can now look back at their time on that newspaper as an honorable undertaking and not something that they did with just to make a payday.
You know, what I want to ask you, I've read a lot of feature stories in my time that made a place or a person seem just wonderful, nearly flawless. And then I've been to the place or met the person and realized that they don't measure up at all to the kind of positive press that they were getting in the feature stories. I wonder how you feel having written a feature about this newspaper, and it seemed really good to you from a distance when you were writing about it, but you found all these problems once you became a part of it.
Well, I think that's one of the lessons that I learned, is that things aren't what they seem to be. I obviously knew that about a lot of other things before, but when I looked at the newspaper, it was under one set of circumstances, and I think if I wrote about the State Department and then ended up in the State Department, I would see a different State Department. There's obviously a vision that other people can communicate to any reporter that emphasizes the positive. You look for the negatives. If you don't find them, then you're at the mercy of what you're being told. You can't make it up or cast aspersions or get paranoid and think everything is a lie. You must, to some extent, as a reporter, trust some of your sources. I mean, what I wrote in my article was in fact true insofar as people said it to me, but there was another reality beyond that.
Is this going to change the way you write feature stories? Or the way you report?
Oh, I don't think so, no. I mean, this is not I mean, I've felt disappointed by larger things than that.
After you resigned from your editorial position at the Mexican paper, you moved back to New York. Did New York seem different to you after you returned, having been gone for a long time?
Well, yes. I had been gone to Mexico for about 6 months, but before that I was in New Orleans and the South for 3 or 4 months. So I had been gone from New York altogether about 10 months. And in the interim, the Howard Beach thing had happened. And I guess that, combined with a few other things in the city, had, to my sensibility, heightened the racial tension in the city. And I was struck when I got back to New York how few people, few poor people, feel in control of their lives to the extent that they'll get up and really work at it somehow to do something about it.
You've always been a bit of a romantic about New York, don't you think?
I am, yeah, sure. I mean, it's a city that my parents came from Ireland as immigrants and made my life possible. New York, my life could only have happened in New York.
Now, I understand you're going to be moving to the country soon.
Well, both.
Both?
I mean, I will be living both there and here. I mean, I'm at an age, I'm 52, where I have accumulations. I've got all those Charlie Parker records and all those books and everything and no place to put them if I live in New York City.
Does moving to the country have anything to do with returning back to New York and seeing it differently than you did before?
Oh, no, no. No, it's really just a matter of how do I have the room in order to live like a human being for the last 20-odd years of my life? I'm not moving to the middle of Nebraska. I'm an hour and 15 minutes from 72nd Street, so although it's called the country, it's really I'm hardly pulling a Thoreau and heading to Walden Pond to contemplate the life of frogs. It'll be something still connected to New York City.
Pete Hamill, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Author and journalist Pete Hamill is a columnist for The Village Voice. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
We're following the situation in South Korea, where it seems that Roh Tae-woo, the designated successor of President Chun Doo-hwan, is about to make some very serious concessions, or has offered to make them already. And also we'll have news about the announcement for president, the official announcement of Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee, and a long special report on dark matter.
What is dark matter?
That is exactly the question. People are puzzled by what dark matter is, and nobody knows for sure. All we know is that most of the universe seems to be it, dark matter.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of the British miniseries The Life and Loves of a She-Devil. It's based on a novel by Faye Weldon. David says She-Devil is one of the top 10 miniseries of the decade.
Last week, I didn't review The Life and Loves of a She-Devil. It sounded too strange, and it's stranger than it sounds. It's shown Saturday nights on Arts and Entertainment, a cable network that a lot of people don't get. And it's just so bizarre a program that a positive review might make me look like a tasteless jerk, or maybe even a pervert. But now I can't stop myself. This week, A&E will present part two of the four-part Life and Loves of a She-Devil miniseries, and I urge you to find a way to see it. If not, you'll never know what you're missing. And what I love most about She-Devil is that if you do see it, half the time you won't believe what you're seeing. She-Devil stars Julie T. Wallace in her first major TV role. She plays a housewife named Ruth, who's dumped by her husband Bobbo for a rich romance novelist named Mary. Mary, played by Patricia Hodge, is a stunning woman. Ruth isn't. She's tall and overweight, plain and frumpy. She looks like one of those women who model Russian swimwear in the Wendy's commercials. At first, Ruth tries to cope with Bobbo's infidelities, but finally cracks while his parents are visiting and spills his secret. The parents fight and leave. Ruth runs into the bedroom and locks the door, and Bobbo screams at her from the hallway.
I now see you for what you really are. You're a bad mother, worse wife, A dreadful cook! Terrible woman! In fact, I don't think you're a woman at all! You're some sort of demon, a devil, a she-devil!
Rather than be insulted, though, Ruth takes his criticism to heart.
I will change myself. I thought I was a good wife. But he says I am a she-devil. So be it. Peel away the wife, the mother.
The rest of the miniseries is all about Ruth's thirst for revenge. She manipulates everyone and everything in her superhuman and sometimes supernatural quest to get even with Mary and Bobbo. She burns down her house, dumps her kids on Mary and Bobbo, and takes off. That's only the beginning. The rest of the plot is too much fun and too outrageous to reveal. I will say, though, that as Ruth the She-Devil gets more powerful and assertive, she also gets richer, smarter, and more attractive. Wallace, as Ruth, gets to play about a dozen different women and seduce or ensnare almost everything that moves. It's an amazing performance. There's word that movie director Susan Seidelman plans to remake She-Devil as an American movie, starring Meryl Streep as the other woman and, get this, Madonna as Ruth. That's like casting Richard Gere as Quasimodo, and would be about as painful to watch. This She-Devil is special because TV never gives starring roles to women like Wallace. No miniseries would be complete without a heroine who seeks revenge and attains wealth and power. But name another one where the woman is 6 feet tall and weighs more than 200 pounds. It's something I won't forget, along with the nudity, the sex, the bondage, the seduction of the priest, and the dental scenes that outdo Marathon Man. She-Devil has something to offend everyone, but its message and its execution are addictive. When it fails, it's fascinating, and when it succeeds, it's like nothing I've ever seen before. And any time television delivers something I've never seen before, I'll be there.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
I am invigorated. Self-knowledge and reason run through my veins. The cold blood of the She-Devil.
Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Carl Finch, leader of The Brave Combo, a Texas rock band that plays polkas and has revived dozens of unhip songs. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile The Remains, a Boston-based rock band. And book critic John Leonard will review Don't Tread on Me, the selected letters of S.J. Perlman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Research assistants from Karen Merdrick and Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.